Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked through Dante's masterwork comedy all the way to the second terrace of Purgatory proper. We are at the beginning of Purgatorio Canto 13, Purgatorio, the second canticle of Dante's work comedy. We have come through Inferno. Wow. Did we ever? We are yet awaiting Paradiso. So we're going to start out with lines 1 through 21 of Purgatorio Canto 13, my English translation. As you well know, you can find it on my website, markscarborough.com, or walkingwithdante.com. You can print it off. You can make your own notes. You can continue the conversation with me. I certainly appreciate those of you who engage with me on social media, through emails, and also who give generously to help support the finances of this podcast. And without anything else to say, except all the big thank yous, let's get to it. Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 1 through 21. We were at the top of the stairs where the mountain that descends us is sliced away for the second time. That's where another shorter terrace belts the slope with an arc, just as the first terrace did, although this one's curvature was a bit more pronounced. No shade was there, nor were any visible signs apparent. The embankment and the smooth path itself seemed to be the livid color of the rock. If we stick around here for someone to ask, my poet said, I'm afraid that our choice will perhaps be put off for too long. Then he set his eyes directly on the sun and made his right side the axis of his movements as he rotated around the mountain with his left side. O sweet light, in which I enter in full trust along this new road, he said, please lead us along in the way that one would wish to be going. You heat the world and shine over it. If some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, your rays should always serve as our guide. This is why you slow walk through comedy, because if you're quick walking, you miss these 21 lines, which are just crazy. I can't explain to you how much ink has been spilled on it. There are so many difficulties here. I hope to be able to elucidate some of them for you. If, you know, you're just reading this thing, let's say in a grad seminar at, I don't know, let's pretend you're reading it at 5 cantos a clip. This is the kind of thing you just blow right past and you need to stop and slow up, because Dante enters the second terrace of Purgatorio with just an absolute corker of a passage that includes some incredibly difficult bits. Given all that, let's just tear right into it. We're going to take this bit by bit, so we're going to start with the first 9 lines. We're at the top of the stairs, so they climb those stairs from the first terrace of pride up now to the second terrace. It's nice. Dante starts Canto 13 with an extremely naturalistic detail. We know exactly where we are. We've kind of been caught up. It's almost, that line almost helps us rehearse what's happened, the climb out of the first terrace. It reminds us that the plot is ongoing. It's a really nice little slight naturalistic touch. And then Dante drops it on us with the next 2 lines. The top of the stairs, where the mountain that descends us is sliced away for the second time. This is a wild word, dismala, in the medieval Florentine. This would come from the verb dismalare, to descend, to unsin. It would come from that verb if that verb existed, but apparently this is a word that Dante has made up. We call that, in Dante criticism, a neologism, a new word. And here we have a grand new word that sets us onto the terrace of the second terrace of Purgatory, that Dante gives us a very easy, okay, here we are, and then he drops this neologism on us, cues us that everything is not exactly as we think it is. But let's go on in the passage. That's where another shorter terrace belts the slope with an arc. So these terraces run around Purgatory, as you now know, and this one is shorter because the mountain is conical, so it's getting shorter as we go up. It belts the slope with an arc, so from where Dante and Virgil are standing, they can't see the full circle around the mountain. They just see the arc. It goes just as the first terrace did, although this one's curvature was a bit more pronounced. In other words, they're getting smaller. The circles are getting littler as you go up, so the curvature gets sharper, more pronounced, as I translated it. Sharper is a good way to put it, too. In other words, it's a quicker turn to go around. It's still a long way around. It's only the second terrace. It's nice that Dante, again, gives us such naturalistic detail. It goes on. No shade was there, nor were any visible signs apparent. The embankment and the smooth path itself seemed to be the livid color of the rock. And the word here, livid, is livido, from the Latin livor. And I just want to talk to you about this for a minute. Livid or livor is a bluish-gray color. I know this is gross, but think about cadaverous flesh. Or think about when white people... white people particularly get scared, and they blanch and the color drains out of them and they get that livid color, that blue-gray color. I think this is really important for us to see in terms of the emotional landscape. If we just set these first nine lines up and let's not think about what this terrace is about, let's leave that aside for the moment and just focus on the emotional landscape, because if we're reading this, we don't actually know what's happening on this terrace yet. All we know is we've come to a space. What is this space? Well, it has a lot of really sharp naturalistic details, the curve, the top of the stairs. It's empty. No shade was there, nor was there any visible signs apparent. So the first terrace of Pride was very crowded. There were those intaglios along the side of the marble. There were the grave carvings, as it were, in the roadbed itself. There were the penitents walking along. This is emptiness. Everything is the same color, this blue-gray, ugly color of rock. I think that's very important for us to see. You know, the white, brilliant white marble of the first terrace, very ostentatious. This, no, not so much. It's very somber, and it feels very empty all around. Nice bits of emotional detail, but again, the overall feeling we get is emptiness, with the exception of a linguistic problem. That word descends, dismala. This automatically kind of sets us up that although it's empty, it is not free from the creation of new words, or let me put it in more modern terms, it's not free from the imagination, or it's not free from the ability to craft language in a way that expresses it. It's a desert landscape that can be expressed in new ways. That right there will set the tenor for all of what happens on the terrace ahead of us. But there's one additional problem in these first nine lines, and we might as well get to it. It's that line seven, the third tercet's first line. No shade was there, nor were any visible signs apparent. This is a wildly ambiguous line. Let me tell you that the amount of critical ink spilled on this line is unbelievable, and let me tell you why. What it says in the medieval Florentine is no shade, ombra, was there, and there also wasn't any visible sign, segno, present. It's that ombra segno problem. Ombra can mean many things. It can mean shade, as in the spirit of a dead person. And we've seen it used to describe the dead in the afterlife. It can also mean shadow. It can also mean a reflected image. And it can mean an image, an artistic image, in and of itself, an ombra. So that word is ambiguous. What isn't there? I can't see any of the penitents. Is it that there's no art there? Is it that there's no shadow cast by anything in this gray landscape? Is it that there's nothing decorated, no decoration, no image there? And then it gets worse. Nor were any visible segno, signs apparent. We've had that word before, segno, to refer to the intaglios, carvings, art, signs. But it means a lot more than that. Segno in the medieval Florentine can mean statue, it can mean a piece of art, And it can also mean miracle, the way we use the word a sign from God, a miracle. It can mean that too. In the middle of this emptiness, we have a line that is incredibly hard to understand. We could translate this dozens of different ways. No dead shade was there, nor were any visible artworks apparent. No shadows were cast there, nor was any miracle apparent. No images were there that weren't even carved intaglios there. There's so many ways to read this line, and I think it's really important in the middle of this desert landscape to not only see the new word, descends, dismale, that Dante's coining in the passage, but it's also important to see that the ambiguous landscape itself lands on an ambiguous line, a line that hollows out because the words mean several things at once. I believe that Dante is intentional here. The emptiness we feel at not really fully being able to know what this line means is indicative of the further and larger emptiness of the space itself. It's there, but what does it mean? The rocks are livid, but what does it mean? There are no penitents visible, but what does it mean? In the same way, we look at this line, no shade was there, nor were any visible signs apparent, as I translated it. And what does it actually mean, given the difficulties of the translation of the words? I think Dante has let the emotional landscape actually invade the verbiage, the diction, the word choice itself, which I think is really nice. It's a really beautiful poetic technique and really helps us feel the kind of isolation, or better, the alienation of this space. And alienation will become incredibly important to what happens ahead. All right, let's go on in our passage and pass on to the 10th line, the next two tercets. Virgil speaks up. If we stick around here for someone to ask, my poet said, I'm afraid that our choice will perhaps be put off for too long. Then he set his eyes directly on the sun and made his right side the axis of his movements as he rotated around the mountain with his left. Several things are interesting here. First of all, just addressing Virgil as my poet. This will become increasingly important over the course of this canto, my poet. And we just want to know that the first time Virgil is referred to in the second terrace, or on the second terrace of Purgatory, he's called a poet. Just hold that in your mind. Remember a coined word, descends. Remember an ambiguous poetic line. Now think of Virgil being called a poet. Remember that this must somehow be connecting up with itself. And then Virgil asks the question, if we stick around here for someone to ask, I'm afraid that our choice will perhaps be put off for too long. Can't just hang out here. If you remember back in Canto 3 of Purgatorio, Cato had appeared at the end of Canto 2 and given his big rebuke. What are you guys doing just standing around here listening to Casella singing? You got to get up a mountain. Virgil is very undignified in the way he runs away from Cato. He scurries off. And then we get to Canto 3 and Virgil's still scurrying, this poor old man who's, you know, trying to get away and up the mountain as fast as he can. And in Canto 3, Virgil walks along with his eyes downcast. He's looking down at the road. Dante, the pilgrim, meanwhile, is looking ahead. And Dante is the one who spots Manfred amongst others of the ones who died in excommunication. He spots Manfred ahead. That's at line 55 of Canto 3. Virgil has fully internalized the lesson of haste. We saw a bit of this on the Terrace of Pride, and now we see it even more. He's really taken to heart Cato's rebuke of get moving, get up this mountain. But you should also note that he has then internalized the way ahead. He asks the question, well, should we wait for someone to tell us? He's looking for the stairs to the next level. But then he just sets off. He set his eyes directly on the sun, and he made his right side the axis of the mountain. So think about how you would rotate around a circle. His right side is toward the center of the circle, and his left shoulder, or his left side, is the one doing the arc of the circle. In other words, he's moving right around the terrace. Now, you might say, wait, I thought that was a thing. In Purgatorio, you always move right. It is, but doesn't it seem as if Virgil has made a decision here? Has he made a decision to go with the flow of Purgatory and go the way you're supposed to always go? Maybe. Has he somehow inferred a direction from previous experiences? Maybe. But we should note that Virgil is on the outer edge. He's standing out at the edge, moving to the right around Mount Purgatory, which means he's closest to falling off. That's very important to what's ahead. What is ahead? Oh, something that has troubled Dante scholars for centuries. What is ahead is Virgil's prayer. The last six lines of this passage. O sweet light, in which I enter in full trust along this new road, please lead us along in the way that one would wish to be going. You heat the world and shine over it. If some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, your rays should always serve as our guide. This is Virgil's only prayer in comedy. Here's what's so troubling about it. Well, several things, but here's one of the things that's so troubling about it. There's no reason for it. He has already set off to the right. This prayer is basically useless in the text. Some Dante scholars in the long history of commentary have actually chastised Dante for this prayer. Virgil has made his choice and set off to the right. Why does he need to pray? What I think they're referring to, or I think what they're responding to, is actually that the prayer is so very pagan. So let's talk about this for a minute and try to figure this out. If this is Virgil's only prayer, then we would have to say that Virgil is still a pagan. This is not a prayer to God. And so he offers a prayer in the way he would know how to pray. As many a critic has said, this is how Virgil would have prayed back in the days of Augustus. Maybe. I don't know that Virgil would have been a sun worshiper back then. It's a little dicey here. Certainly Apollo is ultimately Aeneas's guide in some ways. Apollo the sun, so maybe. No matter what you want to say, a pagan prayer is jarring in Purgatorio. It kind of makes you sit up. If you're blowing through this passage, you don't quite sit up as much as you should. Think about where we are. We're in the redeemed part of the afterlife. Sure, these are the penitents heading toward heaven, but everybody here is already, to use the current word, saved. So suddenly, in the middle of this landscape, we get a pagan prayer? What is going on here? Critics over the eras have offered many different answers. And let me start by saying the early commentators, by and large, see this prayer as allegorical. He's praying to the sun, but we know the sun is a symbol for divine presence. In fact, Benvenuto even claims that the sun is an allegory for divine wisdom. So this is the way a pagan would pray, with the allegory of the Christian God behind it. That seems okay until you see line 19. You heat the world and shine over it. That doesn't sound very allegorical. That sounds very naturalistic. That doesn't seem as if it's a moral allegory. If you remember back to Canto 1 of Purgatorio, at lines 107 through 108, Cato has told them that the sun will guide them up the mountain. So maybe Virgil is further internalizing Cato's advice. Cato has said the sun will guide you up this mountain, and so Virgil is saying, okay, I'll trust it. So sun, guide us. That's a little different in its emphasis than the early commentators, who are almost unanimous in their notion that this is a veiled pagan allegory of Christian revelation, in the same way that they saw, for example, the Aeneid as a vague pagan allegory of the soul's progress to its perfection. Modern commentators are not so sure, and let me tell you that the critical consensus here is incredibly divided. For example, some critics say, well, this isn't really a prayer. I think it is, but okay, this isn't really a prayer, it's an invocation. Well, that seems to be splitting hairs in ways that don't make any sense. An invocation to what? What? An invocation? You know, that's the leading pronouncement, leading dare I say it, leading prayer before a service. But they're trying to split the hair here and not have Virgil pray. This makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. You go, oh, wait a minute, Virgil can't pray. Okay, so he's giving an invocation toward a ceremony. To what? To what end? And how does this function as an invocation? It doesn't sound like an invocation to anything. Some modern critics say that this is a beautiful blend of pagan and Christian thought. Okay, so Virgil the pagan is here in the middle of the Christian part, the really redeemed part of the afterlife, I mean the super Christian part. So Virgil here is blending Christian and pagan elements, but blend? Can you blend? Is that possible to blend? In the last episode, we talked about the difference between experiential truth and revelatory truth, and how we don't really hear this difference anymore because we've accepted that there are two kinds of truths. We've accepted that there's experiential or experimental truth, i.e. Aristotle. And if you are still a believer, you have accepted that there's revelatory truth. And then you get into this really difficult position in which what happens when the experiential truth contradicts the revelatory truth. So you find out that the universe is billions of years old, but the holy scriptures seem to indicate it's, I don't know, about 5,500 years old. So how do you reconcile it? And then you get into this difficult thing of saying, well, experiential or experimental truth trumps revelatory truth. Okay, to bring that back to this, that's the problem of the blend. Does the paganism trump the Christianity here? Because there doesn't seem to be any Christianity here. Instead, it seems to be an invocation to the sun. So I'm not sure the blend makes total sense. Some people say and write, and it's pretty common right now to write, that this passage is an invocation to the Franciscan Canticle of the Sun, a canticle that is quoted in Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury in the Quentin section, if you know that work. This is a reference to the Canticle of the Sun, and so Virgil is reciting it, but does that make sense for Virgil to know the Franciscan Canticle to the Sun? I don't think that makes any sense. Virgil wouldn't have any access to knowing Franciscan hymns and Franciscan prayers, so how does that exactly work? Of course, some people say, still, even today, that this is more allegory about the human reason, and this is Virgil, with only reason as his guide, invoking the source of human reason, the sun. But then again, you run right up again against that line 19. You heat the world and you shine over it, which seems to collapse the allegory. It seems so naturalistic. Well, this is what the sun does experientially. Wait a minute. It's not really much of an allegory. And in fact, it's so troubling that a Dante scholar as esteemed as Robert Hollander ultimately says, hey, there's no allegory here. Just let the thing stand. Stand on its own, which is the biggest cop-out I've ever heard. Listen, I love Hollander's commentary, but that's the biggest cop-out I've ever heard, to say, well, we can't really solve it why this pagan prayer is set down in Purgatorio. We can't really know exactly what Virgil's up to. And in fact, those last two lines, if some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, your rays should always serve as our guide. That bit is so contrary to Revelation itself in some ways that Hollander basically throws out his hands and says, well, we should just accept this prayer as about the sun. That doesn't seem terribly satisfying either, but you should just know that these six lines have caused a great deal of wrestling. Let me offer my personal take, current take. Let me also say my current take is going to change by, 3 months from now. But let me offer my current take on this strange last six lines. This is the most pagan Virgil ever gets in comedy. In fact, it's the most pagan he's been since Inferno 6, line 96. That's the moment in which Chaco falls down back, the glutton Chaco, falls back down into the muck, and it is said that he will rise no more until La Nimica Podesta comes. Virgil calls the coming of God, the second coming, in which Chaco will finally sit up again, as the coming of La Nimica Podesta, the hostile governor, the enemy governor. That jumps out at us when he says it about Chaco's recline into the muck again, that he'll be there until the hostile governor returns. But just think for a second what's happening right there. Right there, we're talking about Chaco, and this will pay off down the road. a figure who seems very gleeful at Florence's misfortunes. Remember, Chaco is quite gleeful about saying the white and the black conflict will absolutely undo Florence. Chaco seems very happy at the misfortunes of others. This then is followed by Virgil's rather pagan notion of the Christian God as a hostile governor. And that's the last time we've seen Virgil as extremely pagan until right now. And now we see him again, praying to the sun, acting in a very pagan way. We should remember, one more thing, that when Virgil met Sordello below us in Purgatorio, remember, right at the Valley of the Kings, the Vale of the Kings, and the serpents at night, and the angels coming in, remember all this bit? And Dante's dream, and Lucy eventually carrying him up, Dante dreaming of being Ganymede, all of that bit. When Virgil explains his position to Sordello at Purgatorio, Canto 7, lines 25 through 27, what he says is that he lost the sun. And that's why he's damned, because he lost that thing, the sun. And when we got to that, we talked about how Virgil is schematizing God as light and the sun. But here, he doesn't seem to lose the sun. He seems to find it. And the finding of it leads him in the right way, which is really difficult inside of what Virgil's doing here. And one more thing, let me just say, before we pass off into one final, One more thing. Lines 17, 19, and 21 here rhyme in a certain way. The words at the end of line 17, 19, and 21 are conduci, luci, duci. That is, conduct, lead us along, as I translated it. Please lead us along, conduci, in the way that one would wish to be going. You heat the world and you shine over it. There's the luci, give your light to the world. If some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, your rays should always serve as our duci, our guide. Conduci, luci, duci. We've seen that exact rhyme scheme before in just slightly different way. Instead of conduci, luci, duci, we've seen it as conduce, luce, duce at Inferno, Canto 7, lines 74, 76, and 78. And guess what's happening right there? You don't have to guess, I'll tell you. What's happening right there is Virgil is in his big discourse about the goddess Fortune. Virgil launches into that discussion of the goddess Fortune, who oversees and spins the wheel of this world. The goddess Fortune, that's pagan philosophy being kind of crowbarred into Christian thought. What's happening here? A pagan prayer crowbarred into Purgatorio. Furthermore, Fortune, the good and the bad that happens to other people. This will pay off on this terrace. I promised I wasn't going to say anything about this terrace and what it's about, but now I am. It's going to pay out with envy. What is envy? Which is what this terrace is, as you know from our read-through. Envy is being very upset at the good fortune of others, or being very pleased at the bad fortune of others. So we saw these exact words in a slightly different form, conduci, luci, and duci, in the same order when we heard about the goddess Fortune back in Inferno 7. So there is something here in Virgil's prayer that is tying it back to his rather pagan disquisition on the goddess Fortune overseeing the world. A disquisition there he's pulling out of Boethius. Here he seems to be pulling this prayer out of thin air with one bit of irony left. It's found in line 13. So he didn't know which way to go, right? He says, if we stand here too long to ask someone, we're just going to wait forever. And then line 13, then he set his eyes directly on the sun. Do you know what looking at the sun does to you? You put your eyes out. You can't look at the sun. You're going to get blinded if you look at it. And do you know who's ahead of us? And do you remember in our read-through what they are? They're the envious. And remember, they have their eyes stitched closed and they're blind. And when we come out of this terrace, what happens? Dante looks straight at the sun and is blinded as they leave the envious behind. Something is going on here about blinding. Virgil looks straight into the sun and then offers a pagan prayer. Has it blinded him to the Christian reality? Has it blinded him in some way to what he has learned over the course so far of Purgatorio? He already knew the journey in Inferno. So the new material he's found in Purgatorio, does he look at the sun and kind of forget it? These are all giant questions. And if he forgets it, is that why he then is free enough to offer a prayer that seems very pagan and very naturalistic? He's not saying, oh, divine wisdom, guide us. He's saying the sun, and he's saying this physical object, the sun, warms the world and lights it. He's not necessarily asking for divine wisdom. And yet ahead of us lies Sapia, a character named for wisdom. It's just wild that revelation is here. It's called basically a counterweight. If some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, that would be revelation. We're back to that revelation experiential knowledge thing, that dilemma. It's going to plague us, I tell you, from now on out. But we're back to it, and it's just such a wild pronouncement on it, as if he knows there could be revelation, but doesn't actually know what it is. And so then prays a pagan prayer. Oh, gosh, it's getting more complex by the second. Do you see that what we're about to enter is far more ironic than at first blush? So complicated that hundreds, thousands of Dantistas have wrestled with these 21 lines over 700 years. Dante has really set the traps. I can't help but think he's laughing up his sleeve. Let's read the passage one more time. Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 1 through 21. We are at the top of the stairs where the mountain that descends us is sliced away for the second time. That's where another shorter terrace belts the slope with an arc, just as the first terrace did, although this one's curvature was a bit more pronounced. No shade was there, nor were any visible signs apparent. The embankment and the smooth path itself seemed to be the livid color of the rock. If we stick around here for someone to ask, my poet said, I'm afraid that our choice will perhaps be put off for too long. Then he set his eyes directly on the sun and made his right side the axis of his movements as he rotated around the mountain with his left side. Oh, sweet light, in which I enter in full trust along this new road, he said, please lead us along in the way that one would wish to be going. You heat the world and shine over it. If some other reason doesn't offer a counterweight, your rays should always serve as our guide. Okay, we pulled a lot out of 21 lines, but these are 21 lines that, as I say, have befuddled critics for generations. And in doing a slow walk, this is the point, is to be able to stop and get befuddled over this stuff, to see the irony happening around us, to see the contradictions happening around us, to watch the paradoxes developing all around us. These paradoxes, this paradoxical structure, in fact, will become increasingly important in Purgatorio and then blossom into full regalia when we hit Paradiso. The nature of reality itself will become a paradox. So we're starting down that road. I appreciate your being on the walk with the rest of us. I appreciate all of your comments on social media and on my website, markscarborough.com. Just keep your shoes really tight, because it's going to get wilder as we enter the second terrace. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you soon.